4. The World Navel. The effect of the successful adventure of the hero is the unlocking and release again of the flow of life into the body of the world. The miracle of this flow may be represented in physical terms as a circulation of food substance, dynamically as a streaming of energy, or spiritually as a manifestation of grace. Such varieties of image alternate easily, representing 3 degrees of condensation of the one life force. An abundant harvest is the sign of God's grace. God's grace is the food of the soul. The lightning bolt is the harbinger of fertilizing rain and, at the same time, the manifestation of the released energy of God. Grace, food substance, energy. These pour into the living world, and wherever they fail, life decomposes into death. The torrent pours from an invisible source, the point of entry being the center of the symbolic circle of the universe, the immovable spot of the Buddha legend, around which the world may be said to revolve. Beneath this spot is the earth-supporting head of the cosmic serpent, the dragon symbolical of the waters of the abyss, which are the divine life-creative energy and substance of the demiurge, the world-generative aspect of immortal being. The tree of life, i.e., the universe itself, grows from this point. It is rooted in the supporting darkness. The golden sunbird perches on its peak. A spring, the inexhaustible well, bubbles at its foot. Or the figure may be that of a cosmic mountain, with the city of the gods like a lotus of light upon its summit, and in its hollow the cities of the demons, illuminated by precious stones. Again, the figure may be that of the cosmic man or woman, for example, the Buddha himself, or the dancing Hindu goddess Kali, seated or standing on this spot, or even fixed to the tree. Attis, Jesus, Votan. For the hero, as the incarnation of God, is himself the navel of the world, the umbilical point through which the energies of eternity break into time. Thus, the world navel is the symbol of the continuous creation, the mystery of the maintenance of the world through that continuous miracle of vivification which wells within all things. Among the Pawnees of northern Kansas and southern Nebraska, the priest, during the ceremonial of the Hako, draws a circle with his toe. Such a priest is reported to have said,
"The circle represents a nest, and it is drawn by the toe because the eagle builds its nest with its claws. Although we are imitating the bird making its nest, there is another meaning to the action. We are thinking of Tirawa, making the world for the people to live in. If you go on a high hill and look around, you will see the sky touching the earth on every side, and within this circular enclosure the people live. So the circles we have made are not only nests, but they also represent the circle Tirawa Attius has made for the dwelling place of all the people. The circles also stand for the kinship group, the clan, and the tribe."
The dome of heaven rests on the quarters of the earth, sometimes supported by 4 caryatidal kings, dwarfs, giants, elephants, or turtles. Hence the traditional importance of the mathematical problem of the quadrature of the circle. It contains the secret of the transformation of heavenly into earthly forms. The hearth in the home, the altar in the temple, is the hub of the wheel of the earth, the womb of the universal mother whose fire is the fire of life. And the opening at the top of the lodge, or the crown, pinnacle, or lantern of the dome, is the hub or midpoint of the sky, the sun door, through which souls pass back from time to eternity, like the savor of the offerings, burned in the fire of life, and lifted on the axis of ascending smoke from the hub of the earthly to that of the celestial wheel. Thus filled, the sun is the eating bowl of God, an inexhaustible grail, abundant with the substance of the sacrifice, whose flesh is meat indeed, and whose blood is drink indeed. At the same time, it is the nourisher of mankind. The solar ray igniting the hearth symbolizes the communication of divine energy to the womb of the world, and is again the axis uniting and turning the two wheels. Through the sun door, the circulation of energy is continuous. God descends and man ascends through it. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out, and find pasture. He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood dwelleth in me, and I in him. For a culture still nurtured in mythology, the landscape, as well as every phase of human existence, is made alive with symbolical suggestion. The hills and groves have their supernatural protectors, and are associated with popularly known episodes in the local history of the creation of the world. Here and there, furthermore, are special shrines. Wherever a hero has been born, has wrought, or has passed back into the void, the place is marked and sanctified. A temple is erected there to signify and inspire the miracle of perfect centeredness, for this is the place of the breakthrough into abundance. Someone at this point discovered eternity. The site can serve, therefore, as a support for fruitful meditation. Such temples are designed, as a rule, to simulate the four directions of the world horizon, the shrine or altar at the center being symbolical of the inexhaustible point. The one who enters the temple compound and proceeds to the sanctuary is imitating the deed of the original hero. His aim is to rehearse the universal pattern as a means of evoking within himself the recollection of the life-centering, life-renewing form. Ancient cities are built like temples, having their portals to the four directions, while in the central place stands the major shrine of the divine city founder. The citizens live and work within the confines of this symbol, and in the same spirit, the domains of the national and world religions are centered around the hub of some mother city. Western Christendom around Rome, Islam around Mecca. The concerted bowing three times a day of the Mohammedan community throughout the world, all pointing like the spokes of a world-extensive wheel to the centering Kaaba, constructs a vast, living symbol of the submission, Islam, of each and all to Allah's will. For it is He, we read in the Quran, that will show you the truth of all that ye do. Or again, a great temple can be established anywhere, because, finally, the All is everywhere, and anywhere may become the seat of power. Any blade of grass may assume, in myth, the figure of the Savior, and conduct the questing wanderer into the sanctum sanctorum of his own heart. The world navel, then, is ubiquitous. And since it is the source of all existence, it yields the world's plenitude of both good and evil. Ugliness and beauty, sin and virtue, pleasure and pain are equally its production. To God all things are fair and good and right, declares Heraclitus, but men hold some things wrong and some right. Hence the figures worshipped in the temples of the world are by no means always beautiful, always benign, or even necessarily virtuous. Like the deity of the book of Job, They far transcend the scales of human value. And likewise, mythology does not hold as its greatest hero the merely virtuous man. Virtue is but the pedagogical prelude to the culminating insight, which goes beyond all pairs of opposites. Virtue quells the self-centered ego and makes the transpersonal centeredness possible. But when that has been achieved, what then of the pain or pleasure, vice or virtue, either of our own ego or of any other? Through all, the transcendent force is then perceived which lives in all is wonderful, and is worthy in all of our profound obeisance. For as Heraclitus has declared, the unlike is joined together, and from differences results the most beautiful harmony, and all things take place by strife. Or again, as we have it from the poet Blake, the roaring of lions, the howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea, and the destructive sword are portions of eternity too great for the eye of man. The difficult point is made vivid in an anecdote from Yorubaland, West Africa, which is told of the trickster divinity Edshu. One day, this odd god came walking along a path between two fields.
He beheld in either field a farmer at work and proposed to play the two a turn. He donned a hat that was on the one side red, but on the other white, green before and black behind, these being the colours of the four world directions, i.e. Edshu was a personification of the centre, the Axis Mundi, or the world navel. So that when the two friendly farmers had gone home to their village, and the one had said to the other, "Did you see that old fellow go by today in the white hat?" The other replied, "Why, the hat was red." To which the first retorted, "It was not. It was white." "But it was red," insisted the friend. "I saw it with my own two eyes." "Well, you must be blind," declared the first. "You must be drunk," rejoined the other. And so the argument developed, and the two came to blows. When they began to knife each other, they were brought by neighbours before the headman for judgment. Edshu was among the crowd at the trial, and when the headman sat at a loss to know where justice lay, the old trickster revealed himself, made known his prank, and showed the hat. The two could not help but quarrel. He said, "I wanted it that way. Spreading strife is my greatest joy."
Where the moralist would be filled with indignation and the tragic poet with pity and terror, mythology breaks the whole of life into a vast, horrendous divine comedy. Its Olympian laugh is not escapist in the least, but hard, with the hardness of life itself, which, we may take it, is the hardness of God, the Creator. Mythology in this respect makes the tragic attitude seem somewhat hysterical, and the merely moral judgment short-sighted. Yet the hardness is balanced by an assurance that all that we see is but the reflex of a power that endures untouched by the pain. Thus the tales are both pitiless and terrorless, suffused with the joy of a transcendent anonymity regarding itself in all of the self-centered battling egos that are born and die in time.